From PRX, this is Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. Scientists spotted an orangutan in Indonesia making a medicinal paste out of antimicrobial leaves so he could heal a large wound on his cheek.
To make a long story short, every animal on the planet self-medicates. We have observations and detailed studies from everything, including ants and bees, all the way up to humans who also self-medicate.
Also, a shell plant in Canada obtained millions of dollars worth of phony carbon credits, but it was all legal.
Shell, however, worked a special deal where for each ton that they put underground, they got to sell two of those credits. And so they could get initially $60 a ton rather than $30. But the problem then is it just means you're selling emissions reductions that never happened.
Those stories and more this week on Living on Earth. Stick around.
From PRX and the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios at the University of Massachusetts Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Paloma Beltran.
And I'm Ainsley O'Neill. As summer approaches in the Northern Hemisphere, climate scientists are on high alert. 2023 was the hottest year on record, at 1.48 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's just below the 1.5 Celsius increase that the UN says is the limit to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. But we're already seeing the impacts in extreme heat, intensifying storms, and ongoing droughts. And the scientific community is not just concerned, but distraught. The Guardian conducted a poll of senior authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, reports. These experts produce recommendations on how to tackle the climate crisis. And out of some 400 responses, nearly 80% are expecting a rise of at least 2.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, a dangerous level of heating. Only 6% think we'll be able to stay within the 1.5 Celsius limit. Damian Carrington is the environment editor of The Guardian. He spoke with several of these scientists.
The one that stuck with me was a brilliant climate scientist called Ruth Serrazzo-Motta, who's based in Mexico. She was talking about how she'd been at a meeting of the IPCC and started to really realize what the trajectory we're on looks like and what it means for people in terms of the damage to lives and livelihoods. And it kind of really shocked her. She was openly, she said she got really depressed for quite a long time. She felt like she couldn't really do anything. But she eventually got over it and thought, actually, I've got to do my work.
Ruth Serrazzo-Motta is among the scientists who predict we'll rise above 2.5 Celsius. And she is living the impacts of climate change firsthand. Her home, the Yucatan Peninsula, is a tropical, humid area where last year, temperatures reached a staggering 47 degrees Celsius amid one summer heat wave. That's around 116 degrees Fahrenheit.
She was saying that undoubtedly, you know, many people had died early as a result of these heat waves. And she was sat there thinking, well, all the work we're doing isn't making a difference. And she was really, really upset and, you know, was saying that she continues the work so that the people who are responsible for the change cannot say they didn't know. That was her kind of motivation. They may not do anything, but they can't say they didn't know.
Damian also highlighted how, despite the despair, scientists say we still have time.
Ruth's story was far from the only one. There was a scientist called Henri Weissman from France. He was saying that he had feelings of guilt about, you know, not doing enough and how that had become even greater as he'd become a father relatively recently. But he said that, you know, when he feels despairing, he thinks that climate change is a slow motion disaster. It happens bit by bit. It's not a cliff edge. And the positive bit out of that is that every tenth of a degree is worth fighting for. Every bit you stop reduces that suffering to life and livelihoods around the world.
The Guardian survey also asked, what do you see as the number one barrier to action?
So 75% of the almost 400 respondents to our survey said that lack of political will was the biggest barrier to climate action. And matching that, when we asked them about, you know, what are the most effective actions individuals can take, most of them said voting.
But still, many of the effects of climate disruption are already in progress. One place getting hit especially hard is the ocean. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the seas have absorbed more than 90% of the heat energy trapped by greenhouse gases since the start of the industrial age. And just like with the IPCC scientists, marine scientists are overcome with grief and despair as their work suffers in the face of the climate crisis. For more, I'm joined now by Bob Berwin, a journalist with our partner Inside Climate News, who has been on the ocean beat for over a decade and has seen this eco-grief consistently throughout his reporting. Bob, welcome back to Living on Earth.
Hi, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
So what are some of the impacts that scientists have been observing?
Going back a few years, there have been quite a few mass die-offs of all different types of marine organisms. I think the first time that they were really well documented, going as far back as 2003 in the Mediterranean, when ocean scientists there looked at little, what are called benthic organisms that live in shallow water in the seabed mixed in with the sand and rocks, so little snails and tiny crustaceans, and documented really just a almost complete disappearance of some of these species after just one single marine heat wave. And then if you fast forward a few years, we've had heat wave conditions in the Pacific Ocean that have resulted or contributed to die-offs of marine mammals, some of which have starved to death because the extraordinary heat in the ocean made their food supply go somewhere else, potentially in some cases. There was a starfish die-off, which you all may have reported on a few years ago, that in some ways has been linked to very warm ocean conditions in the Pacific. And there have been mass mortalities of seabirds there as well. And other impacts include things like toxic algae blooms that in turn also affect animals. So there's been documented cases of fish and birds dying because they ate algae or crustaceans that had a toxic algae with them. And so the impacts are quite intense and quite widespread.
And with these ocean heat waves, I saw you quote a statistic from a climate scientist in New Zealand, and it was some pretty scary stuff. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
15 years ago, people weren't talking about marine heat waves even that much because they only happened every once in a while and affected sort of a small area. You know, I'd say really in the last 10 years, they've started to spread so far, become so big and last so long that it's really hard for almost any ocean scientist to ignore them. So just a couple of weeks ago, the scientist Ben Knoll in New Zealand calculated the extent of current marine heat wave conditions, and heat wave conditions extended across about a third of the world's ocean, which is as if you had heat waves across North America, South America, Europe, and Asia all at the same time. So just huge, huge expanses.
During your reporting, you spoke with a scientist named Jennifer Lavers, who studies seabirds. What did she have to tell you?
Well, she's been studying around Western Australia. She's been studying seabird colonies for a few decades and has noticed that these ocean heat waves in the last years have really started affecting these seabird colonies. And she was quite distraught about it and says that she sometimes, when she describes her work to people, is now feeling like her research is now sort of documenting the extinction of this species that she studies, the flesh-footed shearwater. And it's just one of many ocean species, birds and others, that are really being affected by these ocean heat waves.
Now, Bob, you've been on this beat for some time covering the ocean. What have you seen in terms of the progression of ocean health, or, you know, perhaps lack thereof?
Many of the scientists, Jennifer isn't the only one that I spoke with, have a real sense of grief and sadness watching this incredible living system sort of disintegrate in real time and just sort of unseen to a lot of people because it's just below the surface of the waters. You know, it gets in the news when there's a huge fish die-off. Then there's a day or two where you have front page pictures on websites and newspapers if there's just this huge expanse of dead fish. This kind of stuff is going on in the ocean all the time. Just most of the time, nobody sees it. And it's really a big dying. And, you know, there have been studies in the last couple of years warning that we're headed in the direction of some of the greatest mass ocean extinctions known from the fossil records. So from looking at fossils, we can tell, wow, at this time when the Earth warmed really quickly, 350 million years ago, more than 90% of all organisms in the ocean died. Mm-hmm. And we're not there. We're not at that point yet, but these are studies saying we are headed in that direction.
Now, here in the Northern Hemisphere, summer is right around the corner, and so we're keeping our eyes on the hurricane season that's about to start in the tropical North Atlantic. And one of the key factors in hurricane formation is, of course, sea surface temperature. What have you been hearing about the consequences of ocean heat waves on these massive storms?
Good question. The part of the Atlantic that you're talking about is also called by hurricane experts the main development region, that belt of the Atlantic between Africa and the Caribbean. And what some hurricane scientists have been writing about and posting about on social media is that this area is as warm now as it usually is in mid-July when the hurricane season really starts kicking into high gear. And they're pointing out that combined with some other factors, this heat is a warning sign that the hurricane season could be very, very active this year. And there's plenty of research from the last few years showing that the warmer the oceans are, the stronger the hurricanes can be. Mm-hmm. And that they pick up also extra moisture because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. So when some of these storms come ashore, there have been climate attribution studies showing that certain hurricanes dropped a certain percentage more precipitation than they would have in a cooler climate. So all told, this extreme warmth, long-lasting heat wave over that part of the Atlantic is a warning that we could be in for a really severe hurricane season. And this part of the Atlantic has been sort of record warm for months and months. And, you know, at times it kind of calls into question whether a heat wave is really the right name anymore. Because when you think of a heat wave on land, you think of an event that has a certain start date and an end date, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wow, that last summer's heat wave was a doozy. It lasted 2 weeks or... But these things in the ocean are going on for weeks and months.
Yeah.
So...
Bob, what was your takeaway from the scientists you spoke with here? You know, what was the common sentiment among them?
I think they're waving again, and have been for a while, a huge red flag about the threat of global warming to marine life very, very broadly, and thus the threat to people, because these are changes that potentially will threaten food supplies. We talk about ocean heat waves, but projections for the tropical oceans are that by the end of the century, that they will be so warm that there will hardly be any fish at all in the world's tropical oceans. There aren't any fish that are adapted to the temperatures that are projected for the band of tropics just north and south of the equator. And evolution doesn't happen that fast. It's not like a new species of fish can evolve within, you know, 70 years to fill that ecological niche. And so you're going to have like a lot of people, millions of people living in tropical zones who are going to lose an important source of food. So my main takeaway from talking to a lot of these scientists is that we need to stop global warming and hopefully slow the warming of the oceans too, and slow this trend of more and more heat and more extreme heat in the oceans that is really damaging these ecosystems.
Bob Berwin is a journalist with Inside Climate News. Bob, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thanks. Thank you.
After the break, a Canadian Shell plant obtained millions of dollars worth of carbon offset credits for emissions that were never actually captured. Stay tuned to Living on Earth.
Support for Living on Earth comes from Sailors for the Sea and Oceana, helping boaters race clean, sail green, and protect the seas they love. More information at sailorsforthesea.org.
If you're one of Living on Earth's listener supporters, or if you've been considering a donation to LOE, this message is for you. As a nonprofit news organization, listener support is vital to LOE's weekly effort to bring you up-to-date environmental news and information. Your gift to LOE makes a difference and makes our work possible. So thank you. It's Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. The multinational petroleum giant Shell has a plant in Alberta, Canada, that traded millions of dollars worth of carbon credits based on greenhouse gas emission reductions that never took place. According to a study by Greenpeace Canada, the scheme was part of Shell's billion-dollar Quest carbon capture project from 2015 to 2021. For every ton of carbon Shell secured underground, they got credit for 2 tons under the Canadian carbon tax system. While these phantom credits were surprisingly legal, Shell's actions raised questions about carbon capture practices in Canada's lucrative fossil fuel industry. Greenpeace Canada researchers say they publicized Shell's actions to avoid the pitfalls of the past as Canada formulates new carbon credit regulations going forward. Living on Earth's Steve Kerwood spoke with Keith Stewart, a senior energy strategist with Greenpeace Canada.
What we're going to talk about here is perfectly legal, but from your perspective, from many people's perspectives, not exactly ethical. How fair is that to say?
That's totally fair. I have been telling all my friends about this for a while now, and every time they hear it, they're like, that can't be legal, is it? And I'm like, oh no, it's entirely legal. It's literally written into the law, but I don't think it's right.
So Canada has a friendly, benign international reputation, but how does that stack up when we consider fossil fuels and the challenge of climate disruption?
Yeah, Canadians, we like to think of ourselves as Boy Scouts on the international stage. You know, helpful, not that powerful, but, you know, generally nice. But when it comes to fossil fuels, we're a giant. Oil and gas is our largest export. We're one of the largest exporters of oil and gas in the world. We have the third largest reserve of oil in the world. And our oil is particularly high carbon in the tar sands, and about just over half of Canadian oil comes from the tar sands. So it's dirty, it's expensive, we're sending it all over the world, and most people don't know that.
Talk to me, for example, about the regulations around making credits for carbon in Canada there, in the context of carbon capture.
Canada's oil industry has been pitching carbon capture for a long time as kind of their silver bullet solution to pollution. Don't worry, we don't have to phase out of oil and gas. And yes, we have really high carbon oil, but we're going to do this carbon capture and we'll sort of like reduce carbon emissions and it'll all be great. And the Quest project was the first one to do this in the tar sands area. And it captures just under 1 million tons per year. And right now, one of the reasons we did this report is because right now the oil companies are under a lot of pressure to reduce emissions because they're the biggest source. And so they're saying, okay, we can do more of this carbon capture stuff. We can capture, you know, 10 or 12 million tons per year if governments give us enough money. And the government right now, the federal and provincial governments are offering to cover 62% of the cost. That's a lot. I mean, these companies are rolling in cash. They are bringing in cash like never before. They're having record-breaking profits. And yet they're saying, you know, the governments have offered to cover the majority of costs of doing this. New oil companies are still saying, that's not enough, we need more. And we've seen this movie before. This is exactly what happened with Quest. The provincial government offered to cover 60% of costs of this one. It's because it's, you know, the first time they're doing it, it's a trial thing. Shell said, no, that's not good enough, we need more. And so they came up with this special deal for that project where for each ton that Shell sort of pumped underground, they got to sell 2 tons of carbon credits to make extra money. And it resulted in them getting a lot more money over the life of this project. And we were sort of looking at this thing, you know, this is not a great idea. And we're partially raising this now because we want to make sure it doesn't happen again. Because right now they're negotiating over this new deal. We're bringing in regulations to limit greenhouse gas emissions from the oil sector. They're fighting back hard against them. And we want to make sure there aren't these kind of loopholes put into the new rules that are being proposed right now. So let's look at what happened last time and make sure we don't make the same mistakes.
They pump this carbon into the ground. What would they do to get carbon credits? What would they get paid? What was this all worth?
In Canada, we actually have a carbon pricing system. So companies have to pay for their emissions. It's a very complicated system, but it's basically for on some of their emissions, they pay a certain amount per ton. It started at $30 per ton and, you know, went up to $50 per ton. So the idea with this project is for each ton that they pump underground, Shell or whoever they sell the credits to doesn't have to pay that $30 a ton. So it's worth $30 a ton to them. And that's how they get revenue from doing this. And Shell, however, worked a special deal where for each ton that they put underground, they got to sell two of those credits. And so they could get initially $60 a ton rather than $30. But the problem then is it just means you're selling emissions reductions that never happened, which means we're getting more emissions put out into the air because otherwise it would have had to been reduced. And so it's kind of countering the actual potential good thing that comes from this if the carbon stays underground forever by letting other companies pollute more.
Those were the regulations then. What about now?
This two-for-one deal was ended in the end of 2022. And they never said exactly why they were at it. It's partially the price of carbon emissions has been going up. So it's currently like $85 a ton. So they no longer need that extra money. But it was also, I suspect, because the federal government kind of forced Alberta to change their system. The federal government had won a Supreme Court case saying they were allowed to do industrial carbon pricing. The federal government was said, okay, Alberta, you've got to meet our minimum standards. Previously, Alberta had, because Alberta challenged it to the Supreme Court and said, this is illegal. The federal government can't make us do this. Now it's admitted, okay, they're making us do it. So I think what happened was the federal government kind of said, okay, no more of this two-for-one stuff.
What are the numbers that we're talking about here? How much carbon was sequestered here? And how many carbon credits were issued under this Quest program by Shell?
Well, as of the end of 2022, Shell had buried 5.7 million tons of emissions and had got those credits for those 5.7 million tons, and then an additional 5.7 million tons through this two-for-one deal. And the sale of those put together was worth $400 million. So they got, well, 406. So they got $203 million for selling those, you know, additional, what we would call phantom credits for reductions that didn't really happen.
So what did this project then cost Canadian taxpayers?
Taxpayers paid about $750 million in direct subsidies, and then another $200 million in what we would call these phantom credits. So in the end, when you add those two together, it was 93% of the total cost of the project were basically paid through these subsidy programs. And in the end, Shell actually made an 11% profit on it so far. But they only managed to get this positive return by selling those extra credits. And that's why they sort of worked this deal. But, you know, we would say these are some of the richest companies in the world are these big oil companies. The average Canadian taxpayer shouldn't be paying 93% of their costs to clean up their pollution. We have this principle of called polluter pay. The polluter should actually pay to reduce, not be putting out their hand to the taxpayer for that money.
What prompted you to take a look at these carbon credits in the Quest program?
We started this investigation because we know there's going to be some kind of credit trading system in the new cap system that's being brought in. And we were trying to sort of say, okay, what exactly happened with this the last time and make sure that these kinds of backroom deals, kind of like, you know, you can find out about them if you know exactly where to look. We want to make sure that those aren't happening again and that we're going to pull these negotiations out of sort of back rooms and sort of quiet negotiations into the public so the public really knows what's being done on their behalf by decision makers. You got to watch closely what's happening because oil and gas has some of the best lobbyists in the country, some of the best lobbyists in the world, frankly, and they're going to try and get the best deal possible. And we want to make sure that we're watching from the other side to protect planet and pocketbooks of the average person. So we took a look at the Quest program because in many ways it's pointed to as the poster child for how to do this. It's the example that's always used as, oh, here's this great program in Canada that's sort of capturing all these emissions. And we said, okay, well, let's look under the hood and see exactly how good this is. And when you see something like these double credits, I mean, it completely undermines the integrity of the whole system.
Your research shows that there were some very clever moves made by the oil and gas industry around these regulations when it came to accounting for these carbon credits. What about the technology itself? How well does it really work?
There's two kind of issues with carbon capture. One are just the technical thing. Is it going to work over the long term? What we've seen is a lot of the projects that have been built haven't worked very well. Quest works better than most, to be honest. this kind of technology works well for certain types of applications where you really concentrate a stream of carbon dioxide. It doesn't work as well for more diffuse ones. A bunch of times when they tried to put it on a coal plant, it really hasn't worked well. It's application specific as to how well it works. But then there's all the issue of once you put this stuff under the ground, will it stay there? And the oil industry assures us, oh, no, it'll stay down there forever. And like, well, we've got a lot of leaking oil and gas, old wells that were supposedly plugged here in Canada.
Keith, how do you feel about this whole thing?
We're at a really critical time in the fight against climate change. And I just think it's so important that we go all in on real solutions. And part of this is going to have to be fighting back against the oil industry lobbyists who want to keep us sort of stuck in the energy system of the past. And so I think we undertake this kind of research because we want to like pull back the curtain, let people see what's happening behind the scenes, these types of behind the scene negotiations. And I think when people see that, they're going to like push for those real solutions. And I think it's, you know, we need people to get involved because we really don't have any time to waste on getting action on real climate solutions now.
That's Keith Stewart of Greenpeace Canada speaking with Living on Earth Steve Curwood. Shell has said in press reports, including the Financial Times, that their carbon capture plan, quote, played an important role in helping to decarbonize industry and sectors where emissions cannot be avoided.
It's the time in our show where we get Peter Dykstra on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. He's the Living on Earth contributor who's going to bring us a couple of stories from the history books. Hey, Peter, what you got for me this week?
Hi, Ainsley. We're going to go way back to 1885, specifically May 15th, 1885, when the state legislature and the governor of the state of New York created the Adirondack Forest Preserve, a huge area of 681,000 acres. And they did it out of enlightened self-interest. They were concerned that New York City's water supply would be threatened if the Adirondacks were continued to be clear-cut. So they set this huge area upstate off-limits.
Well, providing New York City clean drinking water is so important. Not only do they provide something like 1 billion gallons of clean water to all the city's residents every single day, but New Yorkers will also say it's the reason why their pizza and bagels are so good. And Peter, with you and me both from northern New Jersey, we get to reap some of those benefits.
Oh, no, absolutely. We both grew up in the New York area. And without that high-quality H2O in New York City, it would be, forget about it, one of the largest cities in the world.
All right, Peter, but the tangent aside, tell me more about the Adirondacks.
Not only was there development pressure to build new farms, new large resort hotels, but Adirondack Park remains largely protected today, despite all those development pressures and despite the damage done in the past century from acid rain. But there are so many other preservation areas since Adirondack Park being arguably the first in the U.S., the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, the Cape Cod National Seashore, and many others. There was initially huge opposition to setting these areas off limits. That opposition was conquered. The Adirondack Forest Preserve led the way.
Mm-hmm. All right, Peter, what else do you have for me?
2 months after his inauguration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Tennessee Valley Authority Act. President Roosevelt helped create the TVA, largely to make the Tennessee River navigable and also to bring electricity and jobs to the impoverished region. TVA becomes one of the nation's largest operators of coal and nuclear power plants, so it hasn't always held an environmental value at the highest level.
And Peter, the TVA is still kicking today, right?
The TVA is still there. It's still a political behemoth throughout the region of all of the states in the Southeast, except for Florida. And that political powerhouse is not always working in conjunction with environmental values. You may remember about 10 years ago, in Kingston, Tennessee. There was a huge coal ash spill that polluted a large section of a Tennessee River tributary. The TVA has always needed to get a little extra push in working toward keeping the Tennessee River and its environments clean. It hopefully is going to do a better job in the future.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you for bringing us these stories. Peter Dykstra is a Living on Earth contributor, and we will talk to you again real soon.
Ainsley, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you soon.
And there's more on these stories on the Living on Earth website. That's loe.org.
If you enjoy the stories you hear from Living on Earth, please consider signing up for our newsletter. You'll never miss a show, and you'll have special access to show highlights, notes from our staff, and advanced information about upcoming live virtual events. The Living on Earth newsletter is sent to your inbox weekly. Don't miss out! Subscribe at the Living on Earth website, loe.org. That's loe.org.
Coming up, researchers studied a wild orangutan making his own medicine to heal an injury. That's just ahead on Living on Earth. Here at Living on Earth, we work hard each and every week to bring you the most relevant and compelling environmental news. As a nonprofit organization, we count on you to help. Listener support is key to sustaining the environmental news gathering and reporting that you rely on. Please consider doing your part to support Living on Earth. A monthly donation is the very best way to ensure LOE's work continues week after week. To make your pledge of support, go to loe.org and click donate. And thank you for helping to keep LOE's nonprofit environmental media going strong. It's Living on Earth. I'm Ainsley O'Neill.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. Much of humanity's medicine has its roots in the natural world around us. Think about aspirin, whose main ingredient can also be found in plants like willow and myrtle. Or, for something a little stronger, opiates, which are synthesized from the flowers of the poppy plant. But humans aren't the only creatures who have used plant medicine. Zoologists have long seen behaviors of self-medicating in the animal kingdom. And recently, a paper was published in the journal Scientific Reports that describes the case study of an orangutan who healed his own wound. Rakus is a male Sumatran orangutan living in Indonesia. After he sustained an injury to his face, Rakus chewed up the leaves of the woody vine called akar kuning. He then applied both the juice and the leaves of the plant to his face. Within 5 days, the wound closed. Here to talk to us about this discovery is Michael Huffman, an ecologist who has spent his career studying the ways animals self-medicate. While he isn't an author of the paper, he was one of the reviewers prior to publication. Michael Huffman, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
What makes this discovery new and exciting?
Well, it's the first detailed observation of an animal taking a plant and putting it onto a wound. And that wound apparently healed in a relatively good period of time. But the fact that the male put a plant with medicinal properties on a wound very concertedly, it couldn't be mistaken as just an accident, is very interesting. There have been many reports, unpublished and unscientific, about this type of thing in other animal species. So to have this detailed observation and have it published is very important because it'll wake up scientists in the field to keep an eye on this kind of behavior, because there are previous examples of something like this happening in other species, but we didn't have the details that this paper has provided.
So the plant that the orangutan named Rakus used to self-medicate is called akar kuning. What do we know about this plant?
The scientific name, the Latin name, is Fibraria tinctoria. And it seems to be widely used in Asia, Southeast Asia, as medicine. It has anti-inflammatory properties. It has antimicrobial, probably antibiotic properties as well. And people use it widely. Another interesting thing, the researchers in this team and those from other groups who have been working at this site for a very long time had never seen that behavior before. And Rakus, the male, came in from an outside population, as male orangutans do. They leave the group that they're born into, and they tend to travel around fairly solitarily and try and establish a territory. So he may be introducing a new behavior into this population that will allow these orangutan, if the behavior is transmitted to others, to treat wounds, which can be a serious problem, especially in the tropics. Wounds are hard to heal. They tend to ulcerate, and early treatment and keeping it clean is very important. Animals have an amazing way of healing themselves to begin with. They have a strong immune system, but as we know from other types of self-medication, they also need plants and things to help that process along.
And from what I understand, primates are not the only animals who self-medicate. Tell us more about that.
To make a long story short, every animal on the planet self-medicates. We have observations and detailed studies from everything, including ants and bees, all the way up to humans who also self-medicate. Before modern medicine, all the treatments were happening in the home. People were going out into the forest, finding plants that they had learned from their elders were effective in treating a number of different symptoms. So every species of animal on the planet gets sick, are affected by parasites or microbes or some other type of disease. We have accidents, we fall, we get cut. So every species on the planet self-medicates.
If such a broad range of species do this, then they probably have many different approaches. What are some other ways that animals self-medicate?
The patterns seem to be very similar across different species. Two of the modes that I have been working on in various different species, not all primates, is that in the normal diet, they include things that we would consider things like spices, chilies, gingers, things like that. Onions even have antibacterial properties. So they keep the food from spoiling. They keep down the microorganisms that can give us an upset stomach, for example. Another example that I found really, really interesting is called leaf swallowing. And plants have a self-defense mechanism to prevent animals from overeating their plant bodies. And so they transfer toxic compounds to the leaves, or they'll set up barriers like very small hairs and things that are very hard to digest. And if an animal eats too many of these leaves, then it gets indigestion. So they tend to avoid certain leaves of certain species because of those properties that the plant uses. But some animals have found a way to use that to their benefit. And they'll fold and swallow these leaves that are hard to digest. And what that does is reduces the time that it takes for food to pass through the system. And normally it's up to 24 hours, 30 hours maybe. But what a number of different species, African great apes included, will do is fold and swallow leaves, reducing that transit time to 6 hours. And they're expelling the parasites in their intestinal tract. So they have a physical means of purging themselves of parasites. So it's a cool way of keeping the system clean. And we have examples of this in birds, in bears, in several primate species. It's really an interesting way of controlling parasites.
Professor, you've spent most of your career studying this topic. What got you interested in the subject?
I first stumbled upon self-medication in animals following chimpanzees in Tanzania, in the Mahale Mountains. It was not my research topic, but I was always interested in medicinal plants and how traditional cultures around the world use those plants. And I had the good fortune of working with Mohamed Issef Karunde. He was one of the staff in our research project that had been ongoing since 1965. And I started studying chimps in 1985. And I would often walk with him in the forest. And when we couldn't find the chimps, he would teach me about plants that his family had learned about and used to treat other people in the village. We worked together for probably close to 20 years. And it was the second year into my research there and working with him that we came across a chimpanzee named Chausiku. She did something very interesting. I hadn't seen chimps eat a certain plant until that day. And it was Chaushiku who was doing it. And I asked Mohammadi, what's the name of the plant? And he told me, it's Mujonso. And I've never heard of that name. Tell me more about the plant. But I was interested in what house she was going to eat it. So I was just watching as Chaushiku took this plant and she peeled off the bark and started chewing on the pith. Very, very fresh, like celery. So she was chewing and then she sucked out the juice but spit out everything else. Mohammadi breaks in and says, yeah, it's very, very bitter. I don't know why chimpanzees would want to eat this very bitter plant. We use it as medicine. And I begin to remember that earlier that day, she wasn't well, and she climbed up a tree, built a nest, and went to sleep, but she left her young infant, Chopin, just running around doing his thing. First thing that Chaushiku did was to go to this plant, Vernonia amygdalina. So we were able to understand during the observations of 2 days that she was very sick the first day, really not well the next morning, but by the next noontime, her behavior changed completely. Her appetite came back. Her strength came back. So just those 2 days was the beginning of a 35-year study on how animals self-medicate, and it continues today.
Although science has only somewhat recently acknowledged self-medicating animals, indigenous communities have known about this phenomenon for thousands of years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
As I mentioned before, with working with Mohammadi, we worked for about 20 years together, and it was only around the 7th, 8th, or 9th year of our collaboration, deep into studying animal self-medication in chimps, that one day when the chimps were way, way up in the mountains, we were waiting for them to come down. And then he said, I have a story for you about a plant that my grandfather discovered by watching a sick porcupine. And he went to tell me about how his grandfather, Babu Karunde, discovered a very strong antibiotic by watching a porcupine dig up the roots and treat itself for bloody stools. And I said, well, that's amazing. And he says, yeah, and we have other examples. And I go, what? You mean your family and your tribe know that animals self-medicate? They've been aware of this for a long time? Oh, yeah, we have many examples like this. So I got really interested and I started looking at the literature from around the world. And it turns out that almost every society that I've been able to read about or talk with people from that culture, there is at least one plant that they have learned from animals.
And what are your hopes for the future of this research?
Well, I hope more and more people will come on board and start looking carefully at their study subjects. Look at new species. We know very little about how animals in the ocean self-medicate. There's a lot of plants in the ocean that have toxic properties. Just like plants on land, they produce these things to protect themselves. But I'm sure that animals have also learned that those substances can be of benefit. So that may be one of our final frontiers, as it were, to go to the ocean and see how animals in the sea are dealing with diseases. But there's still so much on land in all the different habitats that animals live in that we really need to look at more. And I think in the end, the more we appreciate how animals exist in their environment, how they've acquired all of this knowledge and how it's maintained within these different societies of animals, different cultures of animals, we'll come to appreciate them more and take better care of the planet. I don't know who said this, but it is so true. Nature doesn't need us. We need nature. So I think we have to take better care of the nature around us and pay a little bit more respect to the animals who are living there.
Dr. Michael Huffman is visiting professor at the Institute of Tropical Medicine at Nagasaki University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's listen now to some of Rhacus the Sumatran orangutan's smaller primate cousins, gibbons, whose howling calls can travel up to 2 miles across the dense rainforests of Borneo. Many animals make some sort of sound to find a mate, warn of predators, or claim and defend their territory. And now their sounds are being used to create music. Living on Earth's Bobby Bascom reported this story in 2018.
For many of us, the staccato notes of a katydid might conjure up memories of a warm summer night. But for Ben Mirren, a katydid's chirp is music.
I hear music in everything.
Ben calls himself a wildlife DJ. He travels the world as a National Geographic explorer to record animal sounds. And with help from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Ben created a website called Beastbox, where users can layer animal sounds over a beat to create their own compositions.
I'm just a messenger for the intricately tuned voices of the natural world. And the fact that nature is always singing is something that is really exciting to me, and I hope can create similar excitement and joy in others.
To make a song, users open the website and then choose one of 7 beat tracks that Mirren created himself. You can choose, say, Great Barrier Reef Beat. Or Sonoran Desert Beat. Then select an animal sound. There are 30 of them. You can add as many as 5 at a time to create a song. So let's say you choose a coyote. Then an eastern whippoorwill. A parrotfish. A Hadida ibis. And lastly, a blue wildebeest. Put them all together, and then your song is complete. On the website, there's a paragraph description of each animal and an explanation of their habitat. Each time a user chooses an animal musician, a graphic of that creature pops up on the screen and dances to the beat. For instance, there's an orangutan in a red leather jacket and matching sunglasses. And a tropical boo-boo wears a gold chain and a red cap. Mirren hopes Beastbox will be fun for anyone, but the graphics and the genre of music are geared towards kids, like 12-year-old Orion Brown. Orion says he likes playing with the website.
I think it's pretty cool. It's a way to get a good education, but also have some fun.
For an additional challenge, users can try to put all the animals from the same ecosystem together with a beat designed for that environment. It's called Beast Mode. Orion chooses the Madagascar rainforest.
The first animal in that ecosystem is the indri.
Neither of us know what an indri is, so Orion reads the description. Turns out they're lemurs.
A small group of indri will wake up in the treetops and begin their morning shoutouts. Indri are large for lemurs, with booming voices amplified by enlarged throat pouches.
All right, what's next in the Madagascar rainforest?
The next one is the lesser Vassa parrot.
He finishes up with the Madagascar long-eared owl, the red-fronted quaw, and the Sayumanga sunbird.
Beast mode.
So what do you think of the song that you made?
I think when you match them up with all the ecosystems together, it sounds better, almost like it's sort of made for the beat.
So you mean when you have all of the same ecosystem, like all of the desert or the rainforest or so together?
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe when they live together in the same forest and, you know, they're making music together comes kind of naturally? What do you think of that idea?
I think that would be a possibility, and if so, I think that would be super cool.
Ben Mirren says Orion is onto something, thinking that the different animal voices complement each other.
Yeah, I would agree with his observation. Animal voices have evolved over millions of years to occupy different acoustic niches in an ecosystem, so they don't compete with one another.
Making yourself heard is critical to surviving in nature. That's how whales find mates across the ocean, and coyotes defend their territory in the desert. Animals living in the same environment are already tuned to work well together, so everyone can be heard. And Mirren is excited about tapping into that existing symphony of sounds.
As a producer, that means my instruments are already mixed. So instead of being a solo musician, I get to be a messenger for the finely tuned orchestras of the natural world.
Mirren says what he wants is for Beastbox to help people learn about nature and create a connection with the natural world.
At the end of the day, understanding and connecting with nature is critical to falling in love with it. And we can't save what we don't love. So I would hope that this opens a pathway for you to find your own sense of connection and love for nature so that you can be inspired to protect it, because this is a collective future we all share.
Living on Earth's Bobby Bascom reporting. And there's much more about Ben Mirren and his Beast Box at our website, loe.org. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Naomi Ehrenberg, Shanze Asif, Josh Kroom, Jenny Doring, Karen Alterman, Swayam Gagneja, Summer Heyman, Maddie Hibbs, Mark Kausch, Mark Seth Lender, Don Lyman, Sophia Pandelitis, Jake Rigo, Andrew Scarrett, Elle Wilson, and Yolanda Omari.
Tom Tiger engineered our show. Allison Lurish-Dean composed our themes. You can hear us anytime at loe.org, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube Music. And like us, please, on our Facebook page, Living on Earth. We tweet from @LivingOnEarth and find us on Instagram @LivingOnEarthRadio. You can write to us at comments@loe.org. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. I'm Paloma Beltran.
And I'm Ainsley O'Neill. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from you, our listeners, and from the University of Massachusetts Boston, in association with its School for the Environment, developing the next generation of environmental leaders, and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems.
PRX.